County Community School Corporation.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Michael Schultz for the appellant, Deborah Mayer. Three issues presented in this appeal from the district court's grant of summary judgment. The first issue is whether or not the district court erred in concluding that as a matter of law, no speech by a teacher in a classroom can ever be protected by the First Amendment if the speech is during instructional time. Second issue that we raise is whether or not the district court erred in failing to engage in the familiar Pickering balancing of interest. And third, whether or not genuine issues exist on the question of pretext. We're going to focus, I think, on the first issue because it's the most important to the case, and that is the district court in this case held that teachers, including Ms. Mayer, do not have a right under the First Amendment to express their opinions with their students during the instructional period, and added, particularly if the teacher's supervisors have directed her not to do so, which of course didn't happen in this case. The district court appeared to be concerned, as it noted in footnote 12 of the opinion, that to hold otherwise would be to say that an elementary school teacher has a constitutional right to speak without limitation on any matter of public concern with her students during valuable instruction time. We think that the statement and the analysis is error because there has always been a First Amendment right to speak on a matter of public concern. The question is one of degrees. The question is, what is the form of the speech? What's the content? What's the purpose of the speaker in speaking on that matter of public concern? And you have to engage in the Pickering balance to determine whether or not the school corporation's interest in regulating classroom speech outweighs the teacher's interest in speaking. The court erroneously concluded that under no circumstances is speech in a classroom protected by the First Amendment. That has never been the law, and it can't be the law, and it should never be the law. What the school corporation and amicus are asking for from this court is to create new law and give them the unfettered right to punish or restrict the speech of teachers in class, regardless of what the speech is, regardless of whether or not the speech is related to the curriculum, regardless of the educational value or social value of the speech, regardless of the teacher's motive in speaking.
A teacher in a biology class concludes that Darwin is wrong, and she's just not going to teach that silly evolution. She's going to teach creationism. Is that protected by the First Amendment?
Probably not. It depends on...
Why not, on your view?
I'm sorry?
Why, on your view, is that not protected by the First Amendment?
Because the issue has to be analyzed from whether or not... And first of all, there's no question, Judge Easterbrook, that the school board has the right to set curriculum. And I want to make it clear, this is not...
Now, my hypothetical, the school board says we're going to talk about evolution. And the teacher says, yeah, but I'm not going to teach that fool Darwin. I'm going to teach my personal views. And given the First Amendment, you guys on the school board have to let me.
And that teacher, I would say, doesn't have that right because the school board does have the right to control curriculum. And what you have in your example, Judge Easterbrook, is a teacher arrogating control of that curriculum, saying, oh, no, I don't like your idea of curriculum. I'm going to impose my idea of curriculum. But that's not what happened.
I think you're
here.
Getting the spirit of the hypothetical. The teacher doesn't say, I'm going to use the time to teach math. The teacher says, I'm going to teach this subject matter, but I'm going to say what I like about it rather than what you like about it. Because otherwise, I don't understand how you can take that position and still defend your client in this case, because what your client is saying, what you are saying on behalf of your client, is that your client can say what she likes about current events rather than what the board tells her to say about current events.
No, we're not saying that. Respectfully, we're saying that she has the right to teach the curriculum, and within the bounds of reason, if what she is doing is teaching the curriculum, and there's no question that that's what she was doing in this case, then she can't be punished for having done so. And as you know from the facts of the case, her response to the student's altogether legitimate, appropriate question was directly related to the curriculum that was approved and given to her to teach. So she was said...
That's why I asked the question I did, right? The teacher in my hypothetical who says everything Darwin says is wrong is directly related to the curriculum of Teach About Evolution. It's just that it's not the school board's view of what should be taught. And here, the school board says, spend some time on public affairs, but don't take sides. And your client says, but I'm entitled to take sides.
First of all, in this case, the school corporation didn't say don't take sides until after the fact. But I understand the spirit of the hypothetical, and I guess we would need to know more. When the teacher decided to run off on his or her own in his or her own direction on curriculum,
did it? As soon as you say we need let's know more, we're not in the world of the First Amendment anymore. We're in the world of good curriculum planning. That's why I'm asking this question. You don't say let's know more. You say my client has a First Amendment right to say what she thinks rather than what the board thinks or what the board wants.
Under the circumstances of this case, my client didn't say anything that the board had told her not to say. She had never been said, don't give your opinion if a student asks a question about peace marches. That had never happened. So the question was totally predictable, and the answer was limited. And what we're saying is, First Amendment analysis is not a bright line. You can't say all speech is always protected or no speech is never protected. That's never been the way courts, including the Supreme Court, have analyzed the question. It is, does the teacher, in taking some liberty with a curriculum, disrupt class? Is it interfering with the teacher's ability to carry out the educational mission? Because if it is, then under Pickering, you can limit that speech. You can control that speech because you're showing an interest. You're balancing the interest of the school corporation in controlling curriculum against the speaker's interest.
Now she was corrected, right? They addressed it, said there was a complaint, and she was corrected. But it seems that that's just a fraction of all the things that were complained about. And in her three-page letter where she's addressing things, she never mentions this. She mentions a whole lot of other things of why that really didn't happen and why she's being blamed for this and that, and that four different people have taught this in one calendar year and all sorts of things. While I understand your First Amendment argument, and but it's sort of a narrow issue compared to her whole termination, isn't it?
We say the facts in this case are hotly disputed, and now you've ventured away from the sort of the broad First Amendment issues in this case, and you're looking now at the he said, she said, and there's an awful lot of that in the record of this case. And our position on that is that the summary judgment can't be granted on the basis of those factual disputes. The court has to construe those in the light most favorable to Ms. Mayer. That didn't happen. The court didn't decide this case based on the facts, as you know, decided the case solely on the legal question. I see that my light has come on. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may take a moment, I'd like to introduce Andrew Witcher, who is a law student at DePaul, who assisted in the briefing and is here today. Judge Easterbrook, you hit the nail on the head with your hypothetical. The point here is the argument that the plaintiff is making is that a teacher has a First Amendment right in the K-12 classroom, as distinguished right now from colleges and universities, to present the curriculum, present the arguments within the class as she determines it to be. Now, in this case, it involved the Iraq War. In your case, it involved the hypothetical involving creationism, which is not so hypothetical, because, of course, that's what happened in Pennsylvania, the lengthy Pennsylvania
dispute. Any of this depends on the fact that this is an elementary school. My assumption is that colleges and law schools can insist the same thing. Right? If Yale decides that it's going to teach the curriculum from a legal realist point of view and have none of any of this formalism in their curriculum, that's Yale's prerogative. I mean, put to one side the fact that it's a private institution.
Your Honor, I'm certainly willing to take a swing at that argument, but I think this court's decision in Piggy at least bypassed that. In Piggy, what the court said is, look, when Piggy introduced this homosexual agenda into, and in this case really departing from the curriculum, this court in Piggy could have said, under Garcetti, there simply is no First Amendment right. It is contrary to what plaintiff's counsel said just a moment ago. There is, in fact, a bright line test. It was created in Garcetti. If you're a public employee speaking in your role as an employee, that's it. You lose. You don't get to Pickering balancing. Okay? In Piggy, this court declined to say that in the college and university context and went on to a Pickering balancing. I am assuming for purposes of this argument that the reason the court did that is it found that there is some academic freedom component in the college and university content, consistent with what Judge Souter and Justice Souter and Justice Kennedy were debating in the tail end of the Sabalas versus Garcetti decision. What happened is everybody, all public employees, received this bright line test except perhaps the university setting. At least that's my argument, because the only cases cited either by the Supreme Court in Judge Souter's dissent or actually referenced in this court's jurisprudence recognizing academic freedom have all been in the college and university context. And of course, there's a reason for that. Colleges and universities are far different from the K through 12. Number one, they're voluntary. The students pay to go. The students may choose their own course and curriculum. All right? K through 12, it's a compulsory. If you don't take your kid to school, you're going to go to jail. Your kid is going to be taken to school for you. Number two, the state has an interest in the K through 12 environment in maintaining a set curriculum, a curriculum, whether we call it, we can argue about the benefits of No Child Left Behind, but the state has a state-mandated curriculum because we have, as a community, as a country, we have an interest in the K through 12 curriculum, our public education system, in teaching a core set of unified values, and education so that we have an advised, intellectually capable electorate. That's the purpose of our K through 12 public-funded education system, which is different from our post-secondary education system. So that's why I make that distinction, Your Honor, and I believe that's the same distinction that was made by the amici who have filed in this case. Now, the core problem, the real problem with what the plaintiffs argue, which is granting these First Amendment rights, was actually brought up by Judge Mannion's question and relates to the April 6, 2003 letter. I mean, in reality, what's this case about? This case has nothing to do with her Iraq War protest. Right, this lady was not fired for her Iraq War protest. In her April 6, 2003 letter, it's found in the appendix at page 70 through 72, she tells us exactly why she thinks she was fired. She writes a letter to the principal saying to the principal, why are you doing these horrible things to me, and then lists them. She says the reason she thinks this is happening, she says, since the day that I announced I would be looking for employment elsewhere for next year as a result of the proposed RIF, you have taken measures to discredit me as a professional. And she lists those. In fact, one of the items she actually lists, number six, she talks about you're infringing on my civil rights. But she didn't say my First Amendment rights or the Iraq War. What she says is, you are infringing on my civil rights in order to appease unreasonable demanding parents, i.e., requiring that I not make a natural hand gesture in class. If this case really was about the Iraq War, she would have mentioned it in this letter. That illustrates the problem. And this is what the court was so concerned with in the Garcetti decision, why they created this bright line test in Garcetti. What will happen in these cases is cases like this, personnel disputes are going to be dressed up in the guise of the First Amendment and brought to these courts. The oral argument in Garcetti was focused, particularly questions by Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer, was focused on the issue of do we need this bright line test and why? And one of the arguments that was brought out is because if we don't go to this bright line test, we are going to have courts sitting as, and this is language from this court's decisions in the Title VII context, sitting as personnel, super personnel departments. These courts, the federal courts, are going to be in a position of reviewing every personnel decision because teachers are paid to speak. That's what they do. And so every teacher that receives an adverse evaluation, this court's had this happen with Vukadinovich. They're going to doll it up into a First Amendment claim and be here. Mr. Vukadinovich has been in front of this court three separate times at separate school corporations doing the same thing. He has dolled up personnel disputes into a First Amendment claim and wasted the time of this court and the lower courts, extensively and the Supreme Court, in fact, in doing this. And that's what we're seeing here. This case has nothing to do with the First Amendment. She made one isolated statement, was told we need to keep a balancing, and it looks like she, in fact, did that. If you look through the termination papers, they have absolutely nothing to do with that. And that's the basis, number one. That's what Garcetti was concerned about, is that cases like this are going to get dressed up in the raiment of the First Amendment and take the time out of these courts and force courts to be super personnel departments. But we also argue as a alternative grounds for affirming the court, if in fact you should find that there is a First Amendment issue and in fact go through Pickering balancing and find that there was protected speech, there's absolutely no link in the record between the protected speech and the termination decision. And even if there was, there is absolutely no basis, and this is contrary to what I think plaintiff's counsel mentioned a minute ago. He said you can't grant summary judgment if there's disputed facts. No, what they failed to dispute and what they failed to prove in this case was that the school's reason for the termination decision was a pretext. It was a lie. Okay? They failed to present any evidence of that. What they did is they said, we think it's about the First Amendment. But they failed to rebut a single one of the affidavits. This is an unusual situation when you have, in this case, seven parents come forward and complain about a teacher. This is a third of the class. Six of the parents specifically requested transfers. We transferred five of them. We couldn't transfer the other ones. It's also unusual that you have two parents that actually filed formal harassment complaints against a teacher. That's unheard of in this situation. Why? Parents don't file harassment complaints against teachers because they're afraid the teachers will retaliate against their children. So for parents to take these extraordinary steps of asking that their children be transferred and ask that they and file harassment complaints against the teacher simply illustrates the problems with Ms. Meyer's teaching style in her classroom that have absolutely nothing to do with her Iraq War speech or the First Amendment at all. In conclusion, Your Honor, number one, the school would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision, which was based solely on the First Amendment issue, finding that within the context of the classroom, the K-12 classroom, Garcetti versus Savalas applies. This is a public employee speaking in, and this is not disputed, speaking in the context of her employment in the classroom, and as a consequence, that speech is not protected. You do not need to go to Pickering balancing based upon Garcetti. Number two, if the court chooses to move on beyond the district court's decision and look at this with Pickering balancing, we believe that the school has a strong public interest, as this court has noted in its decisions, as well as the Supreme Court, in controlling the curriculum of the curriculum that's being taught to the students in the classroom, which would outweigh any First Amendment right the teacher may have, which was how the Piggy case was eventually resolved. Even though the teacher had a First Amendment right in Piggy, this court said you could not go outside the curriculum and teach about homosexuality. And number three, even if they get past that, and it is a First Amendment speech, we would ask that this court affirm on the grounds that there is no link. The speech was not a substantial and motivating factor, as evidenced by the fact that the court granted summary judgment on the plaintiff's state law wrongful termination claim, which has not been appealed in this particular case. If the court has no further questions, I'll yield back the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Schultz?
Yes, sir.
In roughly reverse order from what Mr. Wheeler just covered, there is literally a mountain of evidence of pretext in this case, and that's why Judge Barker didn't rule on the basis of the facts. There are disputed material facts, and the vast majority of this record is evidence of pretext. The idea that these parents complained to Ms. Meyer is completely undermined by the fact that she was never told, and it was the school's policy to tell her if there were complaints. And that's all been admitted under oath and detailed in great length in our brief in both the district court and here. The Piggy case, and I know that Judge Easterbrook was on the panel, was argued back in February.
Completely irrelevant who was on the panel.
I apologize. The Piggy case says, classroom or instructional speech, in short, is inevitably speech that is part of the instructor's official duties, even though at the same time the instructor's freedom to express her views on the assigned course is protected. Piggy makes it clear Garcetti doesn't apply. And it doesn't matter if you're in K-12 or if you're 20 years old and in college. The level doesn't make any difference. Piggy does not apply. So you're left to decide the First Amendment claim in this case, and that is whether or not a teacher, under any circumstances, has a First Amendment right to speak on a matter of public concern in class. The district court says no and has drawn a bright line rule and has said under no circumstances is that speech ever protected. That's not the law, has never been the law, and we ask that this court reverse and remand the case on that issue, not reach the factual issues because disputed issues exist, and remand the case for trial on the merits. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.